Thanks, Elizabeth. Good morning, everyone. Again, thanks for having me. And just let me pass on also my greetings from your brothers and sisters down in Margate, who, as Elizabeth noted, are meeting right. It's always good to get the invite to come by to Hope and speak, so thank you for that. And thanks for putting on the weather as well. It's fantastic. You know, down in Margate, it was like 25 degrees. I was working on my tan. I was in shorts. today, I'm going to be looking at Job. So I believe this is part three of the series that you guys have undertaken. And specifically, I'll be looking at chapters 12 to 20, or as it's otherwise known as round two, round or conversation two. But before we dive in, have a listen to this famous passage, which, like Job, takes a really unflinching and often excruciating look at the tension between unjust suffering and a loving God. It's from the book The Brothers Karamazov, which is, of course, written by the famous Fyodor Dostoevsky. And I always still feel a bit self-conscious even mentioning that name, because when you say that, people either believe that you haven't really read it, they just think that you looked up the Wikipedia page, or that you're a snob. But believe me, I have read it, actually, and I still enjoy comics, so hopefully I'm guilty of neither of those things. So this is a conversation between two of the brothers. I thought it was. I'll try it again. Is that the side switch? Oh, yeah, I'll turn it off and on. Okay. Yep, now it's on. I worked for Aaron. Okay, that's okay. I think we'll get by without it. This always happens at Margate as well, and it's almost always a visiting speaker. Okay, just bear with me then as I read it. So this is a conversation from the Brothers Karamazov, and it's between two of the brothers. You've got Ivan, who's the eldest brother, and he is rational, he's intelligent, he's a successful, self-made man. And he's also agnostic, maybe an atheist, but I think an agnostic. And he's a really sophisticated critic of Christianity. And he's debating with his little brother, Alyosha. Now, Alyosha is radically different from Ivan. He's a sensitive and devoted young man who is training to become a monk in the Orthodox Church. And so this is Ivan talking. He's an astute observer of human nature and has recently been collecting stories of terrible crimes against children from the Russian press, which he then relays to his brother, Alyosha. And after he's passed on these stories of how all these children have been mistreated, usually by adults, he then goes on to say this. So again, this is Ivan, the critic of Christianity. Listen, if all must suffer to pay for the eternal harmony, what have children to do with it? Tell me, please. It's beyond all comprehension why they should suffer and why they should pay for the harmony. And if it is really true that they must share responsibility for all their father's crimes, such a truth is not of this world and is beyond my comprehension. I understand, of course, what an upheaval of the universe it will be when everything in heaven and earth blends in one hymn of praise, and everything that lives and has lived cries aloud, "Thou art just, O Lord, for thy ways are revealed." But what pulls me up here is that I can't accept that harmony. I don't want harmony. Besides, too high a price is asked for harmony. It's beyond our means to pay so much to enter on it. And so I hasten to give back my entrance ticket, and if I am an honest man, I am bound to give it back as soon as possible. And that I am doing. It's not God that I don't accept, Alyosha, only I must respectfully return him the ticket. Tell me yourself. I challenge your answer. Imagine that you were creating a fabric of human destiny with the object of making men happy in the end, giving them peace and rest at last. But that it was essential and inevitable to torture to death only one tiny creature, that baby beating its breast with its fist, for instance, and to found that edifice on its unavenged tears. Would you consent to be the architect on those conditions? Tell me, and tell the truth. No, I wouldn't consent, said Alyosha softly. How about that? Ivan, the non-Christian, is so moved by the unjust suffering of the innocent, of children, that he says he doesn't want God's ticket to life. Now note that he's still open to the existence of God, but he rejects a God who is going to let the innocent suffer for some greater future good. And he presses his devout brother and asks him one of the hardest questions I think that there is to answer. And that is, if you were God, would you permit children to suffer if it was ultimately essential in bringing about a happy world? Does the overall good warrant the unjust suffering of even just one innocent, a child? And if it does, would you be willing to make that call? That's interesting, huh? What Ivan is effectively doing is putting God on trial. And he finds God guilty. He finds God wanting. And that's not unlike what we see here in the book of Job. We, the readers, we've been given the all-important context of chapters 1 and 2. And we know that it's actually God who is on trial. The accuser, the Satan, he challenges God's treatment of the righteous, saying effectively, the righteous are only righteous because you reward them for being so. And for the majority of the remainder of the book, the reader asks, just like Job, how and why can a good God allow a righteous man to suffer like this? God's goodness, his fairness, it's essentially on trial. That, I think, is one of the big points, if not the big point of Job. And in terms of the section that I'm going to cover today, I'll be making 2 points from these 8 chapters and wrapping up with one hopefully practical suggestion. So here we go. Point one, having some truth amidst uncertainty. So that one of the beauties, not the only beauty, but one of the beauties of reading and studying like large chunks of Job at a time is that you get to go beyond the individual verses, especially the famous kind of uplifting and hopeful and optimistic ones that end up on those often cheesy Christian inspirational posters with cats that say hang in there at the bottom. And you kind of get beyond those to see the larger pattern. And the larger pattern is that Job seems to hold almost contradictory positions at the same time throughout the book. And he holds these contradictory positions almost all the time throughout the book. For example, he seems to both hold that God is attacking him on one hand, whilst also seeing God as his ally and his refuge. So if you look at chapter 13, verse 15, he says, though he slays me, though God slays me, yet I will hope in him. But then we read in verse 24, he also says, why do you hide your face and consider me your enemy? And in verse 26, again of chapter 13, for you write down bitter things against me and make me inherit the sins of my youth. And it's not just his view of God that is complex, but also his view of mortality. So he says in chapter 14, verse 10, but man dies and is laid low. He breathes his last and is no more. But later, and more famously, in chapter 19, verses 26 to 27, he writes, and after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. How my heart yearns within me. So Job seems to go from believing that death is the end of existence to thinking that there is at least the possibility, the glimmer of hope, of a world beyond death, an afterlife. And regarding this issue of whether good people suffer, he says in chapter 17, verse 9, that the righteous will hold to their ways, and those with clean hands will grow stronger. Which sounds to me a bit like, if you do the right thing in God's eyes, your position will be established. But earlier, in chapter 12, he's recorded as pointing out that in ordering the world, God sometimes seems to tip the tables. So we read in verses 19 to 20, God leads priests away stripped and overthrows men long established. He silences the lips of trusted advisors and takes away the discernment of elders. So Job, in total, seems to be uncertain or oscillating about a couple of things. Is God friend or foe? Is there life after death? Do people get what they deserve in this life or not? However, in the midst of this uncertainty, there are two things that he could be certain of, that he seems to hold on to. The first is that God is just, that God is righteous. Sure, Job effectively calls God out and demands that he explains himself to Job, and he even goes as far to describe God as an enemy of his, but he never goes as far as cursing or denouncing God. Job doesn't understand what's going on, but he still believes God. That's the first thing that he seems certain about. The second thing that he seems pretty convinced of is his own righteousness. And by this, I don't mean Job considered himself morally perfect, but I do mean that he thought himself sufficiently upright enough not to deserve the hardship that he was suffering. So look at chapter 16, verse 17. Job says of himself, "Yet my hands have been free of violence, and my prayer is pure. My hands have been free of violence, and my prayer is pure." So his hands have been free of violence, which is another way of saying he's never done anyone else, he's never done any other human, any harm. And his prayer is pure, which is another way of saying he's always done the right thing by God. So in those two dimensions, both with his fellow humans and also with God, Job has been a good man. A good man. And he doesn't waver on this throughout the entire book. He maintains his innocence and his integrity throughout, despite his friends, begging him just to fess up to some secret sin that he must have forgotten about or that he's concealing. And despite the fact that pagan religions of the time weren't above encouraging their adherents to make up confessions just to appease their gods, just for the sake of manipulating their gods into doing something for them. That was common at the time. Appease your gods by lying to them, by making up some kind of sin. That was encouraged. Now, I know that we can't be simplistic and hold everyone in the Old Testament up as some kind of model example to follow. But I do find it really interesting that despite Job having mixed feelings along the way, and even really not that certain about his relationship with God, are you friend or enemy, despite all of that, and despite the fact that he has this confidence in his own righteousness, God doesn't give him a hard time about any of that stuff. In fact, God almost seems to congratulate him on his integrity. And if that's true, there's got to be something in that for us as well. Could that be some indication that God values us being truthful when times are hard? We need to hold on to the objective truth in the midst of suffering as well. God is just. God is powerful. But we can also be truthful in regard to what we're thinking and feeling in the midst of that suffering as well. God, what is going on? Why is this happening? I know you're there, but you feel so far away. And God seems big enough to be able to cope with that, thankfully. It's not recorded that, again, he gave Job a hard time about that. In fact, he seems to have given Job's friends a harder time about their simplistic and reductionistic answers to his plight. And I find that personally really comforting, because in the midst of suffering, I want to be able to be honest about how I'm fighting it, while striving to always hold on to the truth simultaneously. And there's often a gap, right, between what you know is true and what you're thinking and feeling in the short term when times are hard, or when you're in the middle of a crisis. So I can know, as Elizabeth said before, I can know objectively and rationally that God has me in the palm of his hand, with both hands. I can know that. But at the same time, it's all too human to feel 1,000 miles away from God. Does that make sense? Like, can anyone relate to that? And you can see that, like, in the human sphere as well. And so as a parent, you can be woken up when you don't want to be woken up at 6 a.m. in the morning by your son who just wants to play a video game straight off the bat and is hungry and wants some Panadol because he's sick as well, and then decides to wake up the dog simultaneously, and then have an argument about you because you won't with you because you won't give him enough time on the screen, and then be screaming at you, and you can know rationally in your head, I love this kid, but at the same time you can feel 1,000 miles away from him. And that's not based on personal experience. So I think you can see that tension there in the human frame, and I think you can see it in the divine frame as well. There's nothing wrong with being honest about how you are feeling whilst clinging on to that objective truth. And there's often a gap between the two. So hold on to the truth. Hold on to the truth, but don't deny the uncertainty. Secondly, as I mentioned before, Job feels like he's owed an explanation for his suffering. He feels deserted by God, and that this too is unjust. So he yearns to put God on trial so that Job could both defend himself and get some answers from God. So in chapter 13, verse 3, he says, I desire to speak to the Almighty and to argue my case with God. Job wants his day in court. He is longing for some kind of explanation. Why has this happened to me? Because I don't deserve it. He, like Ivan, whom we read of at the start, finds the problem of undeserved suffering almost unbearably perplexing. But here's the thing. The very way Job is written is a demonstration of how frequently we aren't going to have our questions about justice and suffering answered. So this is a spoiler alert, but I assume most of you are pretty familiar with how Job ends. He's never actually provided with an explanation of why he suffered, even after enduring everything that he did. So we, the readers, are given insight into what started off the chain of events, but Job is never told, even after he has everything restored to him. God never directly answers Job's questions about justice and suffering. The very structure of the book, it tells us that there are answers, but that there are also limits imposed on how much we can know and how much we do know about suffering. But Job thinks that he needs all the answers. Summon me and I will answer, or let me speak and you, God, you reply, he says in verse 22 of chapter 13. And he also thinks that this suffering he's experiencing and the distance he feels from God is indicative of God no longer being pleased with him. So in verse 24 of 13, he says, why do you hide your face, God, and consider me your enemy? Why do you hide your face and consider me your enemy? Job wants information. He wants God to show up and tell him what's going on. And God does show up near the end of the book. But again, he doesn't tell Job why he suffered. He doesn't explain the situation. He doesn't give Job the answers that he wanted. And as future sermons in this series are going to unpack, God defends himself, if you like. He explains himself, if you like, by taking a completely different tack. He points to his power and to his wisdom, primarily via his creation. And that satisfies Job, so to speak. It almost overwhelms him. Confronted by the sheer scale of God's power and wisdom, Job can have faith. He can trust that God knows best. He doesn't need all the answers anymore because he's had an encounter with God and been reminded of just how truly awesome God is. Job thought he needed more answers, more explanations, but what he actually needed was a reminder, a tangible reminder, of God's wisdom and power. And that was enough to restore his faith in God's justice and goodness. Does that make sense? Job says, look, I just want God to give me X, and that is some explanation about suffering. That's all I want. But instead, God gives Job why. And the why is, again, a reminder, a demonstration of God's wisdom and power. But why is so powerful that Job effectively says, okay, if I've got that, I can more than trust God regarding the X, the first thing that I really wanted. And that brings me to some suggested applications and my conclusion. I've got a close non-Christian friend who comes from a Christian family. Like many of you, no doubt, you have friends or family like this. And over the past 6 years or so, he's lost both parents to sudden and severe illness. And in both cases, he had well-meaning, but I think ultimately misguided, Christians come around and they prophesied over his parents, declaring that God would miraculously heal them in this life and all that kind of stuff. So my friend is now, he's thick in the Ivan stage. He saw his devoted Christian parents who were serving God sacrificially cut down. And he can't reconcile that with a just God. And again, you probably know someone in a very similar position. This is hardly a unique story, unfortunately. And you may even be one of those people right now who's struggling with that. You, like my friend, like Ivan, would dearly like some answers. And I'd like some answers too. But Job, again, he doesn't give us any easy answers. The book doesn't present us with easy answers. Now, please hear me. I'm not suggesting that there's never a place for a good apologetic argument. They have a place. They certainly have a place. But they also have their limits. Like our finite brains and our human nature have limits too. Job points us, I think, beyond the arguments and the knowledge to God's wisdom and power, and says, as a result of God's wisdom and power, have faith, trust, believe that God knows what he's doing. But that, of course, begs the question, where do we see God's wisdom and power? God's probably not going to appear to everyone out of the whirlwind. He hasn't appeared to my friend that way as yet, for sure. And one suggestion is that God's wisdom and power is made manifest, it's embodied, if you like, in his people, the church. Because if we live under God's rule, if we live according to God's design, then we will demonstrate, even in our frailty, even in our weakness, we'll demonstrate by God's grace some of his wisdom and his power in a tangible way. And again, don't get me wrong, there's still a place, certainly, for argument and debate, as long as it doesn't become the equivalent of what we read about in Job, where it becomes unhelpful and entrenched and counterproductive. But even then, it needs to be bolstered by God's embodied wisdom and power. So as a couple of examples, I've seen, and I've seen both of these just this last weekend. On Friday, I was with some mates, all males, both Christian and non-Christian, and we were playing some cards. And one of my mates, my Christian mates, started a discussion about upside-down crosses in public spaces. And it was really fruitful, and it was really constructive. It was done very, very well. It got the non-Christians there thinking. It was fantastic. And then yesterday morning, on the Saturday, some of these same Christian guys were involved in a three-hour working bee at one of our church's close neighbour's place, the Brookfield Shed, which many of you be familiar with. You may have heard that in the recent floods, it got absolutely decimated, like the bottom story that the ground floor got wiped out. And they're having a whole lot of trouble with insurance. So we had about 20 people from the church there yesterday helping clean it up. And the owners were just amazed. They were just stunned that all these people had given up all this time and had brought their own gear to help out and expected nothing in return. That very rarely happens anymore. Now, I'm not saying that what we did was particularly anything special, because most churches are doing something like this, right? You guys are doing a bunch of stuff like this, no doubt. But once you get outside the church, there are very few groups of people that still do stuff like this. And hopefully, being able to demonstrate God's wisdom and his power through things like acts of service will give both our apologetics more credibility, if you like, and also help convince and convict people of the truth after apologetics have kind of reached their natural limits. Because people just won't be able to dismiss my concerns with bad art as the ravings of a loony Christian if they also know that I'm part of a community who give up their time on a weekend to help out others with no expectation of anything in return. Does that make sense? You just can't write me off as a loony if I'm involved in something like this as well. That embodied wisdom and power, again, not ours, but God working through us, makes Christians harder to dismiss. And in some way, gives people just a small encounter with Jesus as a result. And I think that's still relevant. Because you can say, and it's true, that we're in a post-Christian nation. You can say that the debate about same-sex marriage seems to have already been decided. You can say that you can throw a guy underneath the main row for 3 days and call it art. You can say all that stuff, right? And you can say that, if you like, we've been left behind. But I'm still convinced that take away all of that and people still experience pain. People still experience suffering. And they experience that subjectively and they experience personally. And regardless of anything else, any other way that the world has moved on, you cannot dismiss people's pain and suffering. So that is a connection point for us. And it makes something like Job ever so relevant. Because again, Job is full of the reality of pain and suffering. Again, in the Brothers Karamazov, Ivan could always, the older brother, could always out-argue his younger brother, Alyosha. And he could leave him speechless, just like in that passage that I read out before. But Ivan couldn't out-argue or dismiss Alyosha's life. The wisdom and the power that he embodied was too strong and too compelling. But even more importantly, God's wisdom and power reached their apex in Christ. So you'd be familiar, you'd be very familiar with this passage from 1 Corinthians 1, verses 22 to 24. Jews request a sign, and Greeks seek after wisdom, philosophy, knowledge, information. But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, the power of God and the wisdom of God. Jesus is both the power and the wisdom of God. So when my mate is frustrated with Christians, when he's despairing of the problem of why good people suffer, I need to point him to Jesus. Jesus, who knows all about suffering unjustly. Jesus, who was betrayed by those very people who should have known better, but forgave them regardless. Jesus, who was so crushed that he begged that if there was another way, could he please take it, but still fell back onto, "Your will be done, Father." Do you see what I mean? I give my friend all the answers about suffering, all the answers that I know, but that still falls short. And it'd be really disingenuous of me to fall back on general principles and try to apply them to his very specific situation, which is exactly what Job's three friends did, took general theological principles and said, these must apply all the time to you. But I can try to demonstrate that God is both wise and powerful, and hence worth trusting, despite the inexplicable suffering that we can't deny. And I can try to do this by living out and under God's wisdom and power in my life and community, and pointing him back towards Jesus. So let me encourage you, don't skip suffering. Don't deny suffering. Don't fall back on simplistic answers, but outlive it. Outlive it in the sense that embody together as a community both God's wisdom and power, and help people encounter God, his son, even just if it's in a small way, through their contact with you. Point people back to Jesus so that they can really get to know and rely on him through the undeniable suffering that they will experience in this life. Thanks, and just let me pray. Father, we thank you again for this book. We thank you for its absolutely timeless relevance. We pray that you'll help us as followers and lovers of you, to avoid cliches and simplistic answers. Help us both cling to the truth. Help us never distance ourselves from that, but also help us be authentic and honest about times when we're finding it hard and difficult. And I thank you so much that you don't leave us alone. You've given us your spirit, and you've placed us in amongst a spiritual family so that we can offer each other consolation, encouragement, and accountability when needed. And help us be able to demonstrate that in a tangible and compelling way to a watching world who desperately need it.